VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. This is the very last one before the World Cup. I'll be a little bit sad, but a little bit happy as well. Anyway, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm joined in the studio by Alison Rudd, Clive Petty, and down the line from Madrid. Yes, that's right. Despite being on the road, he was able to take time out of his busy, busy schedule just to be with us and you. It's Rory K. Smith. One place to kick off, the FA Cup final. All right, 9 years, the drought is over. Alison, my analytical mind tells me that this is entirely irrelevant because they finished fourth, and I know people love mocking the fourth place trophy and so on, but that actually shows that Arsene Wenger is capable of doing very good things with relatively limited resources, and that's all that matters. And, you know, they played every game at home. They played Hull in the final with cup-tied players. Who cares that they won this?
Well,
but am I wrong?
He cares. I think he cares a lot. And I think I actually believe the whole contract signature, he needed to know whether he was going to win the trophy and what the reaction would be if he did or didn't. I think in some ways to beat Hull City, they were favourites to beat Hull City, the scenes of celebration. I mean, you'd think they'd just won the treble, to be honest, not won a cup final they're expected to win. And the fans bought into it and say it matters. And I think it's like a pressure valve's been released because they're so used to finishing fourth, it doesn't matter. Clive's laughing at me and I don't know why. The pressure valve's been released. So although in sheer logical terms, so what? They won a cup final they were expected to win. I think Wenger got applauded when he went into the press room. I mean, this is a man who's been under enormous pressure and he's looked... I can't operate with people giggling.
Sorry, it's because Clive was making a face, and perhaps, Clive, you can tell us why you were making a face. Is the point? I mean, on the back of what Alison said, is the point that, you know, you're playing a Hull City side who had a good Premier League season, but then again, they're playing without, you know, their two first choice strikers, and you go 2 goals down, you come back, you win, and you got to go into extra time to do it, and all this jazz, and yet it feels like a liberation. Is there maybe a lesson there that the Premier League table isn't the be all and end all, but silverware is quite nice?
I think silverware is quite nice. I mean, they've finished fourth, as you say, for 17 successive seasons. Or not finished fourth, but at a Champions League place for 17 successive seasons, whatever it is.
And they won a double in there too.
But, you know, they have, and they used to have sort of victory parades, but they had one when they last won the cup, and they haven't had one since. You know, so that fact that they took to the streets to celebrate this was obviously important to them. And it's good that for once, two teams in it, actually, it was important to both of them. And I think, you know, as much as you say Arsenal continually, you know, in the Champions League all the time, that getting that monkey off their back for after 9 years was important to them. You know, it's like, that's what made it. I think both teams actually going for it helps the cause of the FA Cup, I think.
When they went 2 goals down on set pieces, did you get the sense that, uh-oh, history repeating itself?
Yeah, you thought... Well, no, to be honest, I've got to admit, even at two, because they got one back relatively quickly, I was fairly sure. And we had a conversation in the bowels of the Nou Camp at half-time, just sort of saying this will end 5-2 to Arsenal. If they hadn't scored that goal relatively quickly, I think they could have got very nervy and it would have been very different, but they did. it's a great triumph for Arsenal. I think what this all shows, and I agree with Clive completely, that as someone who does like the FA Cup, I think it's brilliant that we didn't have a final between two big sides who don't really care about it, and also this won't necessarily be very popular, that we didn't have a final between two smaller sides for whom it was kind of a novel day out. Because I don't think that does any great favours to the competition. I think this, in a sense, was the perfect final. It was a big team who were bothered, and a smaller side who obviously thought it was really special.
Rory, you've been spending too much time with the greats of Barcelona and Real Madrid. You've gone all Ponzi and elitist on us.
No, not at all. I just think that there's... as I say, I realise it's unpopular. I love an underdog, but I quite like it when they go out in the semi-final. But what I would say is that it's strange how fickle football is. Not strange, predictable how fickle football is. But this is a great example, because for 10 years... Arsene Wenger has been telling us that he couldn't give a flying about the FA Cup. He's made that perfectly clear. And now that they've won it, he's acting like it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that's fine, and I welcome that, because he it's important that managers value the FA Cup, because I value the FA Cup, so it's important to me that they do. But I don't think we should pretend that if we're judging Wenger by his own standards, then it doesn't matter.
That game could quite easily have gone to penalties. It really could have. And Wenger admitted they weren't well equipped for a penalty shootout. Imagine,
yeah, they don't have a ball.
They don't have anyone who could strike a ball under those conditions. But it wasn't so one-sided that wasn't... That, you know, I think it's highly probable that Hull would have won the penalty shootout.
Highly probable?
Given he took off Cazorla. He was left with people who couldn't, didn't want to take penalties.
As opposed to Fry, Aluko, and those guys?
But they have... Yeah,
Hull's vast collection of German internationals.
Exactly. No, but what I mean is, that's why it's significant, because had it gone to penalties and, say, they lost the shootout, the mood that this discussion would be incredibly sour towards Wenger's inability to be pragmatic, to rally his troops, to inspire them.
That's the thing with football, that the one result kind of changes everything. But and ultimately it's kind of random, you know, a shot goes in rather than going over, and suddenly, you know, Wenger's a genius in. And I think it's strange that he left the contract thing.
We'll get to the contract.
He won a trophy.
We'll get to the contract in a minute. But I thought there was some significance, though, even though Rory brushed it off, saying because they pulled one back straight away, and the fact that they went two goals down and came back.
You know, there's a point where Arsenal's quality, up to a point, if they carry on playing what they're doing, I mean, you know, they got that goal back. Was it Gibbs who cleared the head off the line to stop them going 3-0 down, which might also have been a turning point? Surely there's a point where Hull had given so much, and the fact that Arsenal quality then becomes the dominant thing in the game, and that's how it tells. That's what good teams probably eventually do.
But you have to hang in there long enough to make the quality count. And Arsenal,
Bottle is a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because there's no question that you can look at that game and say, well, Arsenal showed great character, and that is something we've always accused them of lacking. So credit to Arsenal for showing great character.
And credit to me for pointing it out.
Absolutely, Dab. Enormous credit to you. But less credit to Arsenal for going 2-0 down to Hull.
Well, that's fine, but they're defensive mistakes, they're set pieces. You know, we know there's an issue there. It's not like they went two goals down because they were scared or intimidated. They went two goals down. And by the way, that first finish at Chester, be like, oh, what a wonderfully subtle touch. Anybody want to really argue that that's a wonderfully subtle touch?
No, it was hit and hope, but he meant to hit it. It wasn't a ricochet. I mean, he thought, I'll give it a go.
And if he hit it cleanly, it probably wouldn't have gone in.
About set pieces, we've got to the last game of the season against, you know, Hull. You know, it's no great brainstorm, is it? We're still talking about Arsenal being poor at set pieces. You know, how much do you have to go through a season before
the world,
Mr. Wenger goes, oh, hello, we're not, you know, we should,
the world's
we should do
an
something
imperfect
about this.
Clive, the world is an imperfect place, as you know. All that said about Arsenal, my Arsenal supporting friends pointed out that they had three legitimate penalty appeals turned down. And I hate picking on referees at this stage of the season. And to be fair, the goal that made it 2-2 was not a corner, although I think we can give Probert a pass on that one, because I thought it was really, really hard to spot the Sanogo backheel. But I thought some of these were pretty obvious. The two fouls on Cazorla from Davis and Myler, the Livermore's handball, where Am I wrong here, Alison?
Well, I watched the FA Cup final in a bar in Mallorca with David Dunn, but so with the commentary from the Barcelona game at the same time.
So
these niceties passed me by completely.
Right, we're showing a distinct lack of professionalism here.
Hang on,
Rory, help me out, please.
I want to know, was Alison on holiday with David Dunn?
No, but I spotted him at the bar.
That's a whole podcast
item. I spotted him at the bar, and it started to annoy me that he was watching Barcelona Atletico.
Why?
And not watching the FA Cup final.
Why?
And I thought, I've got to find out why. So I went up to him, all indignant and slightly tipsy, and said, Mr. Dunn, I don't want to be rude, but I'm going to be. I said, why on earth are you watching the Barca game, not the FA Cup final? Anyway, I am watching the cup final, and he pointed to the wall on the left, and I didn't see there was another screen showing the cup final, which he was watching. So I did the whole, I'm really sorry, but I'm glad I clarified it. Otherwise, I'd have gone home thinking you weren't watching it. And he said, you should know me better than that, love.
All right.
I didn't ask him about his contract. He's out of contract. I didn't ask him which club he wanted to go to. I just needed to know that he was watching the FA Cup final. And for the record, everybody, David Dunn watched the FA Cup final.
Okay, that's wonderful. I want a word on Hull City, because we praised them earlier, but I kind of feel that because it's Steve Bruce, because most of these people, I mean, if you look at this team and you ask yourself, who has potential star quality, and maybe Tom Huddleston back in the day, Curtis Davies maybe back in the day, but ultimately this is still a side which plays a back three, which nobody else in England does. Plays Alex, the manager's son, as a sweeper. And Alex Bruce, I think, is actually very limited in many ways. It's almost as if this is the only role he could play. I don't think he's played very much in a back four as a center half. They got Huddleston, who's another sort of player with a very unusual skill set, I think, to say the least. Should we be giving some praise? If his name was, Esteban Brucios, would we be viewing him? No, I'm going to take a leaf out of Tim Sherwood, that's our next topic. But would we be saying, oh, look, he knows his tactics. He's clever. He plays, Steve Quinn between the lines. That's very clever.
Well, I don't think anyone's saying anything negative about Steve Bruce.
They're not saying anything negative, but they're saying, Brucey, the usual garbage people spout out when it comes to managers. Nobody's talking about him as a guy who's a tactical innovator.
Well, Tony Pulis had him as his manager of the season. I think he's had a fantastic
season.
Because
Tony Pulis could nominate himself, who probably would have been a better choice than Steve Bruce, to be fair.
Yeah, but he's had a lot of praise. He's had very limited resources. He's gone under the radar because they were never quite in danger of relegation. And the cup run, that comes quite late in the season.
You don't want to talk tactics because you're English, Roy. I'll give it to you since you're one of those English self-loathing English people. And Rafa Benitez is your mate. Does he
I'm
get
not
any? You're
not
from
English.
You're a Yorkshireman. Sorry. Does he get any extra brownie points for playing a back three? Why does nobody else do it? Do they not understand it? Does Steve Bruce have a tactical dimension that he's not given credit for? Am I just talking out of my rear end?
I would hesitate to say nobody else understands it. It appears that most of the managers are kind of forsaken it a little bit since its high point in the 90s. Whether that's right or wrong, I'm not entirely sure. To me, I've got to say, just on a side note, in the modern game, because of the athleticism that the players have, wing-backs make sense because you don't need two players to track up and down the line, whereas 30, 40 years ago, you did, just players weren't fit enough to do the entire slant themselves. Nowadays, everyone's fit enough to do that, so wing-backs kind of make sense from that point of view. I think the funny thing with Bruce is that at no point in his career has he been seen as a bright young managerial thing, despite having that stamp of Fergie, he's one of the original members of the cabal. And I think that's slightly odd. He's never been thought of in terms of big jobs, despite the fact that broadly his record's pretty good. And I think he is probably a better manager than we think he is. And I think the reason for that is that he looks a bit like, to quote Barney Roney, a family butcher with a secret. And I think that doesn't help.
We're going to have a whole series of mini-debates now because we're running out of season and we need to get through this. But, Clive, I'm going to start with you because Tim Sherwood is no longer the Spurs manager. I don't think it was
much of a surprise there. I think I've asked you before whether he was getting a raw deal, so I won't ask that again. But how much faith do you have in Mr. Levy? And it is Mr. Levy, because as far as I understand, Mr. Lewis has no input whatsoever, even though he owns most of the club, that they will make the right choice. And what will the right choice be?
I'm led to believe Mr. Lewis had some input in Redknapp's departure, but I'll leave that one hanging. I wish I could tell you what Levy's next move, because I'm never quite sure that Daniel Levy kind of knows what he wants from a Tottenham manager either, to be quite honest, apart from the fact, I suppose, he wants the perfect bloke who will, you know, here's your budget, you're not spending any more than that, stop finishing 5th and 6th, get in the Champions League. But no real sort of plan of how you're meant to do that or what sort of person he actually wants. I think Sherwood, keep banding this thing about him having 59% win percentage, the best of all Tottenham managers in the Premier League. But, I mean, surely he just knew he was there for a stopgap. You know, that was always what he was going to be. And I have no idea what Levy is looking for in the next Tottenham manager. I really don't. I'm not quite sure he knows what he was looking for in the managers he's appointed before. He got rid of the manager with the best win percentage before Sherwood, who happened to be AVB, and he, you know,
did he get rid of him, or did AVB get rid of himself? We don't quite. There might still be some debate.
Well, you say that, but we don't know that. If we're led to believe that stuff coming out of Tottenham, Sherwood got rid of himself because he kept all the things he supposedly said that were, you know, bad mouthing Levy and his board. So, you know, if we go down that road, Levy doesn't get rid of any managers, does he? He needs to come out of the hip, stick his head above the parapet one time, actually, and actually perhaps speak to the Tottenham supporters and say, yes, I know we had this guy and I know we had that guy, and this is where we're going now. This is the club we want to be. But we never hear anything from him.
But if he wants a manager who doesn't blab and, you know, tell the secrets of what's been said to him in boardrooms, he should definitely appoint Pochettino, who refuses to speak English publicly.
I think you'll be surprised. He just doesn't like speaking English to people like you or me in the media.
Exactly. That's all that Levy cares about, isn't it?
These things are always a matter of perspective, aren't they? That Spurs' terrible season isn't a terrible season by the measure of kind of 86 other football clubs in the league. Their terrible season is not a patch on Man United's terrible season, for example. I think Alison and Clive are right, though. I think the issue now is, what does Levy want? And also, kind of deeper than that, is what do Spurs think they are? Because, this is something that will keep recurring, but those top six or seven, if you include Everton, who I think are run on slightly different lines, not that they're a smaller club, they're run on an understanding that they have to punch above their weight. Those big six, say, are going to have to realise to an extent that there are only four spaces in the Champions League, and that means that occasionally they're going to miss out, and that could be to do with, you know, injuries, as you say. It could be to do with unfortunate refereeing decisions. You can't chop and change the manager every year because you don't finish in the top four. And I think the problem that Spurs have got is that Levy doesn't seem to understand that sixth place for Spurs is pretty much on par. That's the amount of money they spend on their wages. That's probably where they are in terms of, roughly in terms of kind of history and in terms of kind of modern sort of present day expectations. That's roughly what Spurs are. Sixth is a par finish. But Levy doesn't seem to be able to kind of realise that to get to that fourth place, you don't have to build something. And I think that's the problem, that it appears that Pochettino's the favourite, and I think that's an intelligent appointment, because I think Pochettino's an excellent manager. But what happens if Spurs only finish fifth next year, or fifth the year after? Just the intimation seems to be that will cost the manager his job, that failure to get in the Champions League will do for you.
I'm not sure that's... I don't know why Levy all of a sudden is portrayed as some kind of like trigger happy loon. I mean, you know, if you throw in the Redknapp period, it's three managers in 6 years. I don't think that's completely completely crazy. I don't think that's sacking a manager every year. I think basically the reasons. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We know why Redknapp eventually went. We know why AVB went. We know why Sherwood went. And I don't think any one of those guys you point to and say, they left because Levy didn't think they were good enough.
But equally, if you're Pochettino, and Pochettino, if you look beyond his I think perfectly sensible refusal to speak English, he is a fiercely ambitious manager. He genuinely believes he can be a Real Madrid manager, a Barcelona manager, you know, a Juventus manager, whatever. He wants to do big things. if you go to Spurs, there is a very good chance that you will do reasonably well, and still that won't be enough. And in 2 or 3 years' time, and I agree with you, he's, you know, Levy's not Maurizio Zamperini, but in 2 or 3 years' time, it may well be that you find yourself under pressure, and when you get under pressure, your stock inevitably falls. It's the same reason I can't quite understand why Frank de Boer is so interested, as far as I can tell, all Frank de Boer has to do is sit at Ajax for as long as possible, and eventually he'll be Barcelona manager. Why go to Tottenham? It doesn't make any sense. It's kind of a zero-sum game.
So wouldn't Pochettino... Pochettino should be better off going somewhere else other than Tottenham? Because I don't see where from Southampton that kind of route...
From Southampton, it's a more logical step. I think that the way that Levy's run Spurs would maybe sow seeds of doubt in your mind if you were a very ambitious manager.
I don't know. I look at Spurs as a squad, and I kind of think if you're Pochettino, you look at the other managers. I imagine Pochettino looks at the people ahead of him in the table, should he get the job, and say, do I believe I have between the squad and the manager, is my group better than Arsene Wenger's? And I bet Pochettino believes, thinks he is better than Arsene Wenger. And I think he believes he is better than what Everton have. With the squad he has right now, I guarantee you Pochettino must believe he can finish top four or top three. And then if he doesn't, you know, then he might come up short. Enough Spurs for the next many, many months. On a rather controversial note, Richard Scudamore, if you miss the story, it's the kind of story that sort of came out and then sort of thought it might go away, but it didn't. It's still here, and it looks like it's getting more serious and possibly in terms of the reactions to it. But for those who missed it, it kind of goes like this. The Premier League hired a temporary PA. She worked there for about a week, I'm told. She got access to Scudamore's emails, contrary to what some people wrote. It's my understanding that they weren't automatically sent to her. And she found some of the language used in there sexist and disturbing, in particular some of his conversations with a man named Nick West, who's described as a super lawyer in some newspapers, which makes me like him instantly. In particular, Nick West used some unpleasant language referring to women. Scudamore made some, what he thought at the time were jokes, referring to, do I need to go into this much detail? I'm sure we all know what it is. We're referring to a colleague of theirs named Edna, whose real name is actually Peta, P-E-T-A, which I thought was a funny name I hadn't heard before, saying that she needs to stay off his shaft or something like that, some other joke about London buses. And you were used the word broad, which I don't think has been used since the 1930s, unless you're a fan of musical theater. Roy, I'm going to start with you for obvious reasons. I believe in privacy, and this is the guy's private email, and I have a problem with somebody going into somebody's private email and then publishing it, selling it if they sold it, or giving it to a newspaper. On the other hand, if the content is so shocking, then there's a public interest element here and it needs to be looked at, right?
Yeah, I'm not entirely comfortable with the idea that you could... I mean, Scudamore is a public figure, although the Premier League is not a publicly owned company. He's not a minister. He's not kind of in charge of any of us. He just runs the business. I'm torn, to be honest. He's clearly been crass, and the stuff, I hate the word, the really controversial word that he's used. I can't stand it. It's interesting that no one's trying to pressure Nick West to resign. Why isn't that happening? Do you know what I mean?
He's being investigated, apparently.
The thing with Scudamore is that he's clearly been crass. As I say, it's a horrible word. He's behaved badly. Do I think it should be a matter of which he should lose his job? No, I don't, not really. And I've got to say that there seems to be this feeling that the media are protecting Scudamore, that we're all his mate. I've met Richard Scudamore, I think, twice. Don't know him at all. Not exactly the best friend of the Premier League. But it's not. He's not been racist. He's not been homophobic. Right. He's not been particularly sexist. It's purely and simply, it's horrible behaviour. But then, you know, rich businessman behaves like a bit of a rude word. Is that really a shock?
The train is now approaching Junction at platform.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm not sure it is. Obviously got some fairly old-fashioned views, but that shouldn't cost you your job.
I'm sort of in two minds about this because of my views on privacy. I'm open to being educated here, but just for comparison's sake, I had a major problem with the fact that Paul Elliott was forced to resign because of a term he used in a private conversation with somebody else a while back. And I thought it was kind of disgusting how that got leaked and it was used to beat him over the head with it. I think in some ways, I hate the way in the media, we often ask, especially when there are people who aren't very represented, like women in football writing, to speak on behalf of everyone. So I'm only going to ask you to speak on behalf of yourself. But
thank you.
Your football is a sexist industry. Newspaper, the media is a pretty sexist industry. Certainly, there aren't very many women represented, and they are in the fluffy pages, but not in sport, not in the toy department. I mean, does it make a difference if it happens behind closed doors or if it's kind of the run-of-the-mill behind the office or run-of-the-mill in an office environment or whatever else?
The way I came at it was thinking back to the Richard Keys and Andy Gray debacle. What happened there was the female staff they worked with just became so across with their... they would regularly be sexist banter. And that's why their comments were about Sean Massey were leaked, because they just had enough. And it then transpired that I think something similar happened. People said, well, you know, just one mistake. And then people realised they had a bit of a history not behaving terribly PC and being generally quite sexist. And it built and built, and they became this picture of a pair of blokes who were just far too blokey and far too dismissive of women that they might come across in a workplace. And so I thought, well, I'll apply the same thing to Richard Scudamore if it transpires that this is just one example of many examples of him not promoting women because he thinks they're idiots or, you know, time of the month problems, whatever it is he's got an issue with. Or if other women come out of the woodwork and say, you know, I overheard him discussing what I might be like in bed or whatever, and he sexualizes women in the workplace and it's entirely inappropriate, then he should go. But if all it is that he's engaged in a bit of email to and froing with someone who was the other person was the one who instigated the more demeaning phrases, then I don't think it's a sacking offence. But it does become a bit tiresome that when people say, oh, I don't, it's about privacy and it wasn't that bad really, it does seem to me quite clear that there are three things that you're not supposed to do, but sexism is the least awful of them. And if he'd said, oh, don't get caught in a room with someone who is gay, or if he'd said, that would be homophobic and he'd go by now. And if he'd said, oh, don't trust that guy because he's black, he'd have gone by now. But you are allowed to get away with a lot more if you have a go at women. It is considered fair game.
Yeah, that's true. Wrong.
And I think this, well, even picking up on that sort of privacy thing, even more to that, it kind of highlights, I think, we're going back to that kind of blokey thing and the environments of which we're working in. It's the lack of kind of perhaps diversity amongst all of that. You know, they're allowed to do that because it's still, in all sort of aspects of football and boardrooms and the Premier League, still very white, very upper middle class, very blokey, not very women, no black people. Heather Abbatt's kind of, she's probably great for them because in the FA, she takes several boxes.
If only she were to come out.
Well,
instead, she's married. Sexy Mike Lee. All that said, I take your point on that, but still, it's still a conversation between two people. So unless you take diversity to the point where there is nobody else in your sort of racial, socioeconomic class.
No, but you won't ever cut that out. These things have to change in time. And at the moment, I agree with Maureen Allison.
I want to ask you, though, about Allison's point, because I thought it was really interesting. Out of all of us, you're the only one who actually decides what is news and what gets in the newspaper. While this may be a minor infraction, can you justify running this story with the possibility that it might prompt other people to come forward, people who maybe have had more significant contact with Scooter Moore, because ultimately we are talking about somebody who'd only been there for 1 week.
The thing about the story is, once you've taken into account kind of what was said and who said it and the circumstances and trying to get to the context of it, I think we are at that point where we've reached that point where it's becoming a story now, which is actually kind of what happens to Richard Scudamore and how this private company, which is the Premier League, reacts to it. The reading of it was that he is, a bit like what we said, he's guilty of acting stupidly at the moment. So you report that man says this and acts stupidly, and this is the sanction taken to him. He should be wrapped on the knuckles for acting stupidly, in my opinion, if anything else happens to him by this private company, which is the Premier League, then that's what we reported. I think the difference being, as I think Roy pointed out, is he's not a government minister. It's maybe a public figure, but he's not publicly funded or anything like that. So it's not as if the man in the street, he is accountable to him. He's accountable to certain people that he works for.
Well, he's accountable to the stakeholders in football, which go beyond the 20
and they
clubs,
and they're allowed to give their opinion. Right. It seems to be that they have, there've been people queuing up to give their opinion of what he said, and that's been reported.
Enough of this. Financial fair play settlements came out on Friday, late Friday. Thank you, UEFA, for making newspapers and media organizations' lives easy. If you want to go into the whole nitty gritty about this, there's plenty to read online. And I'm assuming you all know what the punishment doled out to City and to Paris Saint-Germain is. I don't want to debate the merits of FFP here, but I want to throw this to you, Rory. The punishment, is it actually manageable? This business with the squad sizes, because I was struck by one thing. I think a reduction in squad size to 21, a wage freeze, a possible limit on new registrations, especially the limit to 21 while also maintaining the 8 locally trained players, I think that's kind of hefty. Am I wrong here?
No, I agree with you. I think it was a very clever punishment, and I think it's quite a harsh punishment. And I'm not surprised City tried to a point to argue with it. They've obviously put a spin on it, which is that they weren't going to spend more than €60 million net in the transfer market anyway. They've made the point that they only had 21. I think they only used 21 players in the Champions League.
Yeah, but it wasn't Boyata and Richard Wright. In other words, people that they need to fulfil the quota.
So I think that they have tried to save face a little bit and try to kind of dampen concerns that it's a really bad punishment. But I've got to admit, I think it's significant, especially that limited transfer spend, because it puts them in a position where their position in the market is weaker. And I like probably quite a lot of people, have been working under the assumption that the City next year will be stronger than they are this year. But that kind of precludes them going out and doing anything spectacular in the transfer market, unless they're going to sell players a sort of substantial number and financial quantity of players. So I think it's a clever punishment. I think it's shown that UEFA are taking FFP seriously. As you say, the other issue with FFP is whether they're kind of punishing the right thing. I'm not sure they are. But the real scandal, as I'm sure you agree, Gab, is Levski Sofia. I think the way Levski Sofia have tried to queer the pitch in the Europa League is an absolute travesty, and they should have been hit with perhaps the most serious of punishment. That's a joke.
Yeah,
it was really funny that Levski Sofia got punished.
Why?
I don't know. What the hell could Levski Sofia have done to upset UEFA? Have they got like an American potato chip partner or something that's not market value?
No.
They should just let teams like Levski Sofia do what the hell they like.
Why?
Because countries like that are at a massive disadvantage, and that's because of UEFA and the way that they have skewed the Champions League in favour of the big countries. So they should allow the Eastern European nations, the football nations that for years and years and years were genuinely competitive, to play by different rules so they can compete.
Mm. Okay, Zenit,
you can't introduce something called fair play and then say it only applies to you lot. That's the biggest contradiction in terms going.
But yeah, in terms of City, yeah, it's a good punishment.
Alison, are you a union member?
Oh, I don't know. No. Stop being sexist, girl. No.
No, there was a point to this, which is ultimately the idea here, and I think the reason why City and PSG will, you know, while it's obviously painful now, will probably welcome it in the long run, is that this is all about limiting costs and creating an environment where, you know, clubs cannot spend X amount of money, so ultimately their costs will go down. The biggest cost of a football club is wages. I think, and people haven't really talked about this, but I think at some point players might be like, well, hang on a minute. We're the ones who actually generate the revenue because people pay to watch us. Do they have a point?
Well, isn't the way around it with bonuses the way that...
No. That's just a complete myth.
Really?
Yes, it's a complete myth.
But I read it in the rules. Bonuses what? Are not...
Bonuses don't count towards
to
financial
FFP,
fair play?
Yeah.
No. What rule did you read it in?
Well, I haven't got it in front of me, but I read it.
City said that in their statement.
City said in their statement that... bonuses wouldn't count towards the wage freeze that they're subjected to for next year. But that's a special punishment that they negotiated. But, I mean, I think the idea is it's not – there's nothing – bonuses are still expenses for clubs, right? So
– if it's a 12 for City, it's a 12 for anyone else. You can't allow one club to
– no, you can because this is a settlement, right? So City and Paris Saint-Germain –
it's also a precedent.
There's no common law here. This is a specific settlement procedure that both sides agreed to in lieu of going to the adjudicatory chamber. And I can see everybody's already bored, so we can move on from this. But City and PSG are subjected to specific rules that will apply only to them last year. They agreed to them. That's what the settlement means. And that was in lieu of going to the adjudicatory chamber. All right, on to the Champions League final. Rory, we're delighted that you have you there actually doing reporting on the ground. It's Monday, so this news will be out of date by the time people talk to him. But what's the latest as of 12:30 on Monday on Diego Costa?
Diego Costa, we think, has a hamstring injury. Atletico was saying that it's unlikely that he'll be able to play. I would imagine that is the case unless he sort of has some sort of injection of cast blood or something into his affected hamstring. He was in tears on the bench in Barcelona on Saturday. I've got to admit, my personal view, if it is what it looked like, which is a hamstring pull, my personal view, whether he's fit for the World Cup, not whether he's fit for the Champions League final, chances of getting back in 6 days are pretty minimal. He's got a month to recover for the World Cup, just short of a month. So you'd imagine he'd be in Vicente Del Bosque's squad, but you wouldn't necessarily be certain of it.
And Arda Turan?
That one I'm not sure on, actually, as of 12:30 on a Monday, given that I spent most of this morning going to the Bernabeu to get my accreditation for Real Madrid's press day tomorrow. Arda with a quadriceps strain. I would imagine that, too, probably rules him out of the final in terms of precedent and how long these things generally take to heal. That one looked less serious.
Okay, I need you to set, and just to set the scene here, because I'm assuming we all watched it because there was nothing else to watch at that time, unless you're David Dunn. But just the sheer drama of it, Atletico Madrid playing away at Barcelona, they need to avoid defeat to be crowned Spanish champions for the first time in 1996 and only the second time in donkey's years. And all of a sudden, their best player gets hurt and their second best attacking player gets hurt. This inside of 20 minutes, then just when you think that they can still hang on there and gut it out with a bit of luck, Alexis Sanchez conjures up this absurd finish where he just threads the needle, and all of a sudden you kind of feel like it's not going to be their day. But it was. Can you tell us what changed and what it felt like, Rory?
Well, it was an incredible occasion, I've got to say. And as you say, Sanchez's goal was one of those that gets you out of your seat. There's not many of those, especially at the end of the season, when you've been to sort of dozens and dozens of games. But it was a remarkable finish. It really was. It kind of caught everybody by surprise. The entire ground went completely silent for about 5 seconds because no one was quite sure what happened. Because he could try that another 1,000 times and never score it again. But then what happened after that goal was Atletico for 2 or 3 minutes kind of seemed to lose their heads just a little bit. I think they picked up 2 very quick bookings. And then they calmed down and they just went again, to use the phrase du jour. And after half-time, they came out of the block at absolutely breakneck speed. According to Thibaut Courtois, all Simeone said was press Fabregas and Iniesta a bit further and remember that you're better than them. And the first 5-10 minutes of the second half, Atletico just destroyed Barcelona. Godín equalised with a wonderful header. They'd hit the post with David Villa, I think, just before that. Pinto had come off his line to smother another chance of Villa. The ball just wouldn't quite drop for him. And what was most remarkable to take it away from Atletico and on to Barcelona was that Barcelona had 40 minutes to score one goal and they won the lead. After everything they've been through this season, they had 40 minutes just to score one goal against a team that had lost its best player and in Arda Turan, kind of its the best physical embodiment of that side. Arda and Atletico Madrid just fit perfectly. And Barcelona didn't really create a chance and it was mildly pathetic. And if you'd wanted a that you couldn't have asked for a better example of what's happened to Barcelona than the team that scored six in the Bernabeu, that put five past Real in the Nou Camp, that beat Manchester United twice in the Champions League final. They couldn't create a chance in 40 minutes. And well, that's Barcelona with Messi and Iniesta and eventually Xavi and Cesc on the pitch.
I'm going to ask you, Alisson and Clive, what's a better story? Real Madrid making it 10 and Carlo proving that good guys win again and that light will ultimately triumph over darkness? Or Diego Simeone and the ultimate underdog's tale with a bit of debt servicing and TPO thrown in?
Well, if he won the double, I think that would underline his credentials as
Manchester United manager. There you go. Everything's about Manchester United.
The universe, if there is such an accolade.
What? So that's a better story than Real Madrid
it's
making
it 10.
It's a
footballing story.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it is.
Rory, what's the better story?
No, Atleti by a million miles.
It's not. It's a biblical tale of good guys. Come on. All right, time now for some quick hits. Bakary Sagna is out of contract, and he's reportedly mulling over an offer from Manchester City. Alisson, if you were his best friend, what would you advise?
If I saw him in a pub in Mallorca, like what I saw David Dunn.
Exactly.
I would say, Bakary, how can you leave? They were singing your name, Bakary Sagna, we want you to stay. In a way, if he decided to U-turn and he said for a long time he wants to go, but if he U-turned and said, I want to stay, I can see great things happening at Arsenal, that I think that would be quite significant because there must be quite a few Arsenal fans already come Monday thinking, oh, I don't know, has anything changed really? If Bakary Sagna can say, my only chance of great silverware is with City, I could do it at Arsenal, then I think that'd be good for everybody.
All right, so you want him to stay rather than go and be Pablo Zabaleta's backup.
Yeah.
Diego Costa looks to be on the verge of joining Chelsea for around about £32 million or so, the well-informed tell us. Rory, is he the answer to Mourinho's questions?
He is the perfect striker for Mourinho. He's powerful, he holds the ball up well, he scores goals out of nothing. He tends to be a bit sort of patchy in that he'll score a lot of goals, usually early in the season, and then fade a little bit later. No, I can see why Chelsea want to sign him. I don't think there's any better options out there. The one caveat is that his career trajectory doesn't make him an obvious star. He's kind of had two big seasons, but before that, not much really. That could be that he's a slow burner, and it could be that, you know, like Drogba, he will come good later in his career. It could be that these are the exception rather than the rule, but that's the risk you're going to have to take these days.
It could also be that he had all sorts of issues, so to speak, earlier in his career, especially with discipline. It's Derby versus Queen's Park Rangers in the Championship playoffs. McLaren versus Redknapp, the man who was England manager to the man who was England manager in the hearts of all right-thinking Englishmen. Alisson, who would you rather see back in the top flight? Now, I'm assuming it's going to be QPR because you live considerably closer to Loftus Road than to Pride Park.
Well, the answer's in the question. But if I take out geographical bias and selfishness, I would
it's
like...
Harry.
I would
well, we
like,
need characters in the Premier League.
I would like Derby.
Breath of fresh
I would
air.
Like Derby as a club to be given another chance.
They were rubbish last time.
Exactly. Give them another chance.
Unlike
they
QPR, who were
such
stellar.
An iconic club. And it's, I don't know, people, there's a generation of people who don't know what Derby County are, so give them a chance.
Tony Evans writes in today's paper that the key to a successful national team is improving the 45 or so guys who can actually get picked for it, rather than fiddling around with B teams or getting hundreds of Englishmen in the top flight. Rory, given that he's our boss, I'm assuming you agree with him, as do I, in the strongest possible terms.
I don't mean... You have to do one rather than the other. I think your aim should be to do both, surely, to have the biggest possible pool of high-quality players.
The that perfect is the enemy of the good.
Fine. But no, I see what he means, that you want to have a core of high-quality performers, world-class players, but you also want to have a lot of people of your own nationality to choose from, such as countries like Spain, Italy and Germany enjoy.
Yeah, but if they're 30-year-old reserve right-backs, why they got to be English? You're never going
to
pick them anyway.
What are you talking about? 30-year-old reserve right-backs? They need to earn a living too, Mark Offley.
It's my euphemism for rubbish. England players were off on holiday this past week before meeting back up with Uncle Roy for training camp. Clive, do you think they all behaved during their time off?
When you say behaved, I mean, are we talking sort of the fact there's a lack of kind of dentist chair stories still going around now, or just they kept themselves fit and trained like that nice Frank Lampard does?
Well, I'm assuming there were snappers chasing them, people looking and paying sources for stories of bad behavior.
Well, we don't seem to have
like
found
in years
them,
past, but there aren't any, so aren't maybe any. They are actually more professional.
I think that possibly as the squad is kind of getting younger, and this continental influence of, you know, how professional the foreign players have been since they've been over here, perhaps that has rubbed off on them. It's their first, for a lot of them, it's their first kind of major tournament or World Cup coming up, so they don't want to do anything that would jeopardise that. And to be quite honest, I'm still waiting for that story to break where, you know, that gets at the England team and it's all the media's fault. And we haven't had that yet. And there's still time. They've still got to go to Miami, of course. You know, so you never know. I mean, we're still looking for, what is it? We haven't got the World Cup, as we said today, really. We haven't got that World Cup part of the body yet. This year's metatarsal. When's that going to come into play?
I know they're going to Miami, but I let me assure you, there's no way you can get in trouble in Miami. No temptation there.
Gab, I have a question for you. It's always a surprise to Gab, I have a question for him. Tiki Taka is officially dead, so I'm assuming Bayern and Pep Guardiola did not win the double.
No, they did win the double.
No way. No way.
But they didn't do it playing particularly well against Borussia Dortmund. Dortmund also had a goal disallowed. Hummels may or may not have been offside, but the ball did cross the line, showing, proving once again that in your brilliant hipster Bundesliga, they're nowhere near as good as the Premier League because they don't have goal line technology. It wasn't great for Pep. They did have injuries. He played Pierre Hoiberg, who I thought was pretty bad. Obviously, no Mario Mandzukic, who was very upset and who has been linked to a move to these shores. In the end, I think it was about getting another trophy for Pep, and the reality is Bayern Munich entered 6 trophies this year, and they won 4 of them, which I think is pretty impressive. Let's judge him next season before we pronounce Pep and his style of football to be deceased. Many, 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 many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd, Clive Petty, and Rory K. Smith. Many thanks also to our relatively competent producer, Dave McGuire, who's done a wonderful job behind the scenes after taking over from the evil Chris Skinner. You can check out thetimes.co.uk. It's the perfect way to read our wonderful content without worrying about getting print ink on your hands. And if you prefer being an ink-stained wretch, well, that's still available to you at your local newsagent as well. As I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, this is the last podcast of the domestic season. However, we're going to be back broadcasting once a week during the World Cup. And I'm delighted to say that both hosts are joining me here in the studio. Alison, you excited to host?
I'm so excited, old hat.
You've been done before. And Clive, you'll be hosting too, so I'm told.
Bring it on. I've been studying you for weeks, Gab.
There you go. Learn from the best, and not just them, but learn from me as well. It's been a pleasure. It's been a privilege. Are we back next season, McGuire? You're nodding. Fingers crossed.
Gab, give the producer the bottle of champagne you got for him for the season.
He doesn't drink, though. You don't drink, do you?
He's a finely tuned athlete, McGuire.
All right, enough of this. Till next time, it's been fun. It's been real. Have a good one.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Hi, I'm Tim Montgomery, the presenter of another Times podcast from the opinion pages called Did You Read? It's the perfect weekly snapshot of some of the best writing in the newspaper. Find out more by heading to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and search Did You Read to subscribe on iTunes.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.